Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Welcome to The Audible. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined by Bruce Feldman. We're going to talk a little college football as always, but Bruce, I just wanted to say real quick thank you to everybody who gave us kind words about the podcast we did last week about the ESPN layoffs. If you haven't heard that yet, go find it on our Apple Podcast feed or Google Play or wherever you get your podcasts. It says ESPN layoffs right in the title. It was kind of depressing, honestly, but we've heard a lot of people say they appreciated that conversation.
Yeah, and look, I think it's really beyond just ESPN. I think it's kind of an industry-wide thing. So, again, I would like to be more optimistic about it, but I think there's a lot of things in the job world that sometimes feel like they're trending in that direction. So, but moving along, this is the first podcast we've done since the end of the NFL draft, which is really finished up over the weekend. Before we get into some larger topics in that, there was one thing that kind of struck me as that we should talk about this. So you and I both agreed Deshaun Watson was the best quarterback in college football last year, right? Even though we didn't vote for him for the Heisman, fair to say, after him leading Clemson to a national title?
Yeah, and in fact, I can't remember a situation where college writers were more united in defense of a college prospect.
Right. So our friend Barrett Salee, who's been a guest on this podcast, I saw he had tweeted out early this morning a reminder that we live in a world where a group of professional football scouts willingly took Mitchell Trubisky over Deshaun Watson. Now, while I would tend to agree with him, I do keep in mind that like those guys who do it, and it's not just a professional scouts, it's because a lot of times scouts aren't the ones who make or the decision maker in there. It could be it's a GM usually, but what's the reality that those guys whose livelihoods are tied into it actually know more about their game than we do?
Well, so I'll take it twofold. First of all, I think this would be a different story if you were comparing two players with similar profiles. Like, for instance, I believe Colt McCoy and Sam Bradford were in the same draft. They played about the same amount of football. They both had success. NFL was obviously a lot higher on Bradford. This is a case where they, and by the way, didn't just take Trubisky ahead of him, but the Bears traded up to number two just to get this guy. You're talking about three-year starter, national champion, two-time national championship game versus one-year starter, Sun Bowl. And I think that's why we're all so indignant. But beyond that, do they know more about evaluating quarterbacks than I do? Yes. But I also feel like, and I said this on Twitter Thursday night when he slipped to number 12, I think they outthink themselves sometimes. Peter King's MMQB Monday morning was fantastic. It had all these behind-the-scenes details from inside the 49ers war room. And he said there were more, like almost 30 people inside that room. These guys, it's just too simple. They don't take the simplest route.
Stu, there's also 30 people inside the war rooms at Ohio State and LSU and every other program come signing day, too.
So, yeah, I see what you're saying, but I'm not. are all those people involved in every little decision along the way of the recruiting any scholarship player that Ohio State offers? No, are there 30 different people weighing in?
I don't think they're taking it up to a vote and saying, hey, you know, regional scout from the ACC, what do you think versus this? You know, like they all have their own process, but I don't think it works like that.
So, I mean, I just think they spent 4 months analyzing the tape of these guys. The easy route would have been, well, Deshaun Watson, national champ, Heisman runner-up, we're taking him. The will look like geniuses route is taking the guy from UNC who played 1 year but who looks great on physically. We're going to trade up. He's going to become our franchise quarterback, and we're going to look like heroes. And I just think they outsmart themselves sometimes in an attempt to be, you know, because like kind of like we're saying, right, like you and I, they don't have to pay anybody. They could just ask us, who would you take? And we'd say Deshaun Watson. These guys, God knows how many millions of dollars they invested in the scouting process to be able to say, we did all our homework and we feel very confident saying Trubisky is better than Watson.
Yeah, I think having said that, though, there's a lot of times we would be wrong. I mean, I think a lot of college football media would have said Vince Young, right? A lot of them would have said Tim Tebow.
I was very high on our guy, Matt Leinart.
Yes, I was too. But Tim Tebow, great college quarterback.
So what's the biggest knock on Watson is the interceptions, right?
Yes, they don't trust his accuracy downfield.
Well, it's funny that I've become to his defense like this because, as you know, I was down on him all of last regular season because of the interceptions. And I've said it on here several times. I just kind of did a reversal once we got to the playoffs and I started to understand their offense better. And the fact that they had Mike Williams and they had Artavis Scott and all these guys, and they could just Deion Kane, and they could just take chances.
Leggett, yeah.
I think I don't know. You know, you can tell me who Watson gets compared to the most in terms of like physical mold, but in terms of profile, it reminds me a little bit of Matt Ryan. Matt Ryan came out of BC, and he's kind of similar, like a lot of interceptions.
But Matt Ryan did not have the kind of athletes around him that Deshaun.
Well, he also didn't lead his team to the national championship. So to me, that at the time seemed questionable. I remember questioning, why do they consider him this good? And then he obviously lived up to it. So I don't know. To me, the greater success of his profile. Now, I'll tell you what, the one Trubisky Watson, we've been conditioned to that debate for months. The fact that Patrick Mahomes, who you at one point on this podcast said that you had a QB coach in the NFL tell you he was undraftable, number 10.
That he would not be a starting quarterback, that he would not take him as a quarterback in the NFL.
Number 10 in the entire draft ahead of Watson. To me, that's even riskier. Why is he... I'm not saying you shouldn't ever take an air raid quarterback, but why is he the exception to Graham Harrell and eight gazillion other guys who come out of the system?
He has a way bigger arm than Graham Harrell does.
He has a tremendous... I mean, you've seen the tape. He throws the ball 70, 80 yards downfield. It's like, I can't remember who said this once, but they're like, these guys that get so obsessed with the arm strength, like how often... you're never going to have to throw 70 yards in a game. You know,
I don't think it's that throw, Stu, that necessarily is the one that the NFL scouts look at. It's the throws, like it's the deep out and how slow the ball gets out of his arm or not, how much juice there is in his arm. And that was the thing I had heard about Nate Peterman. They didn't think he had enough juice to drive the ball where he was. They thought he was really smart and that he could play in the NFL. But that's the reservation. That was a reservation on Graham Harrell. To be honest, that's a reservation on on Matt Barkley. You know, that there are a lot of guys that they just don't have enough arm to make the kind of throws because the window is so much smaller in the NFL than it is in college.
If Matt Barkley didn't have arm strength, how was he the consensus big time quarterback recruit coming out of high school?
Because he has enough arm strength to do it in college. It's just a different game.
I will never understand fully what these guys are looking for. At one point,
Skylar Howard put up really big numbers for West Virginia last year. Now, he obviously doesn't have prototype size, but he didn't have the arm that I think they realized was going to translate to the NFL.
How about CJ Beathard? going ahead of Brad Guthrie, Kaya.
Yeah. Again, I think that that's like a case where it's like Mahomes. It's beauty's in the eye of the beholder. I think you could ask 10 different personnel guys and you probably get 7 different opinions.
So can we kind of look at a little bit bigger picture here? One of the stories of this draft to me from a college perspective is the fact that the Big 12, our friend Andy Staples has the data. Here we go. Most players drafted by conference. The SEC once again leads with 53, ACC 43, Pac-12 36, Big 10 35. You assume the Big 12 would be the fifth one, right? But no, it's the AAC with 15. You know they want to be known as the Power Six, and they are one ahead of the Big 12 with 14. They do have more teams, but so if you go by per school, then it's Big 12 1.4 per team, AAC 1.3, but that's way behind the other power conferences. And by the way, it's not all that unusual for the Big 12, which had 1.6 in 2014, 2.5 in 15, and 2.6 last year. Those are all below, well below the SEC, ACC, Pac-12 level. You know, we've said it before, but this is extremely disturbing, you know, for the Big 12, because there's a direct correlation, but, you know, we mocked them a lot last year. They did not have much success. They didn't even, you know, their champion couldn't even contend for the playoff. And then the draft numbers come out and it's kind of validates it. Well, they just didn't have the talent.
Were you surprised by this?
Surprised it was that low. Now, I will say for anybody looking to project this forward, you know, this time period that Andy's citing here, I don't think you can stress enough how much Texas's dysfunction contributes to that number. Because when Texas is clicking, they're going to be turning out, what, 7, 8 players a year on their own, if not more. So, I mean, this is a program that has, you know, access to the deepest pool of talent in their state. And, I mean, there have been years recently when, you know, the Charlie Strong's first couple of years inheriting him from Mack Brown, there were a couple of years where they didn't have anybody drafted.
They haven't had an offensive lineman drafted in like a decade, which is mind-boggling.
What did they end up doing in this draft?
Deontay Foreman was drafted.
That's it?
I believe so.
Okay, so I think that all you need to know about, not all you need to know, but, I mean, obviously, when they lost Texas A&M and when they lost Nebraska, they lost two schools that produce, generally speaking, a lot of draft picks. So
actually, Missouri produces a lot of draft picks.
Of course. I mean, they keep turning out. They had another first-round defensive lineman. So, and you replace them with TCU and West Virginia, who aren't putting up those kind of numbers. But even with that, I mean, Texas has had one player drafted in each of the past two drafts. They had 5 in 2015 and then none in 2014. So 3 of the last 4 years, Texas has had no more than one player drafted. I mean, that's insane.
It is a head scratcher. I mean, you know, and I think people can kind of look for all kinds of reasons. I just think it speaks to the lack of talent and they haven't recruited that well. You look back to last, just, you know, whatever it was, 2 months ago, was signing day. There was one Big 12 program, Oklahoma, that had a top 25 ranked class. I mean, that's – it should not be that way. It just shouldn't. And, you know, looking further, the best players, the most highly recruited players in the state of Texas ended up – most of them, almost all of them left. I think Texas signed only one of the top 20 ranked players on 247's rankings in state, and that was the number 20 player, Sam Ellinger. More than that, in this draft, and this is about the Big 12 we're talking about, 4 of the top 10 players were Texans. 3 are from the DFW areas, and none of them went to Texas. The only one who went into the Big 12 was the 10th pick overall, the aforementioned Pat Mahomes. So I think that's the huge role in it. They're not getting the best players in the state of Texas.
And, of course, one of the main reasons the AAC had more picks was because Houston had a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, big shout out to Tony Levine because I think he had 6 of his guys that he recruited in those 3 years have ended up getting drafted.
Well, I was just going to say the guy who coached them the last 2 years is now the coach of Texas. What about this observation from Andy? See if you agree. What don't NFL teams like about the Big 12? Only the offenses and the defenses. Going into last season, the Air Raid and Art Briles offenses had proliferated so thoroughly that many NFL coaches and scouts viewed the Big 12 as a league playing an entirely different sport. Last season, Kansas State had the only offense that didn't come from either the Hal Mumme, Mike Leach, or Briles teams. NFL types especially hate the offensive line play because players rarely operate out of three-point stances. And even though the teams pass quite frequently, players don't have to hone many of the pass protection skills they'll need in the NFL. With Mahomes being a obvious exception, do you think the kind of offense they play in the conference is hurting NFL player development? And if so, I would think that's having a direct impact on recruiting because guys want to go where they know they can get drafted.
I don't know if I agree with that just in this regard. You know, when Kevin Sumlin got to A&M, Cliff Kingsbury was his offensive coordinator. You know, then he had Jake Spavital, who came from, they have a run a variation of the air raid. And they've had 11 offensive players drafted just since 2013, offensive alone. And of those, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them are offensive linemen. Now, to me, again, not everybody runs what Leach runs, but that has been a variation since someone's been there of the air raid. You can say Noel Mazzoni doesn't do it, but that was only last year, this past year. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure I buy that.
So then it is more just, you know.
I just don't think the talent is just good enough. I mean, I you know, see these teams up close, and I don't think when you look at even the top teams, you know, Oklahoma State, one of the better defensive players in the conference was Vincent Taylor, defensive tackle. It wasn't like he got drafted high. You know, you just look and see a lot of these guys who are just, you know, they have some talent, but I really hate to say it, but I think in the last few years, their talent, especially on defense, is closer to the AAC than it is to the SEC.
Ouch. And then I was just looking at Oklahoma. Now, they're the two-time defending conference champ. I believe they've only lost one conference game in the last 2 years. And they've had guys drafted, but I want to just compare here, okay? Peak Bob Stoops, 2010, you had Sam Bradford, Gerald McCoy, Trent Williams, and Jermaine Gresham all go in the first round. They had three more guys later than that. The year before, the 2 years before that, they had five guys go each of those years. 2006, they had six. 2005, another big year. Jamal Brown, Mark Clayton, first-round picks. Brody Poole, Mark Bradley, and Dan Cody, second-round picks. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more after that. Okay. So coming off these two Big 12 championship teams, they had this year Joe Mixon, second round. Dede Westbrook and Samaje Perine, fourth round. Jordan Evans, sixth round. Last year, Sterling Shepard, second round. Charles Tapper, fourth round. Zach Sanchez, fifth round. Devontae Boyd, sixth round. I mean, those are not the kind of numbers where Michigan had 11 guys drafted this year.
Michigan was a backloaded group. They weren't cranking that out the previous couple of years.
Fine. Guys Alabama, LSU are putting in every year, Ohio State. I mean, clearly, based on what the NFL is telling us, Oklahoma is not close to that kind of elite talent.
No, they are not in terms of the depth. Certainly not, no. But look, Miami had 9, I think, this year.
Miami can't stay off that. Every year they're high on that list, and every year they go 9-4. We'll see if Rick can change that. So I want to transition here to a somewhat related topic. I did my post-spring top 25. It went up Tuesday morning. You probably have seen it by now.
How high do you have Stanford after your visit there? You were all gung-ho. Top 5?
No. Man, you read way too much into those comments. What I wanted to note was that after we just spent all this time bashing the Big 12, and this is not intentional. I don't go into this saying I need to put X number of teams from a conference. It just plays out the way it plays out. Oklahoma 8th, Oklahoma State 10th, Kansas State 14th, West Virginia 15th. That's four Big 12 teams in the top 15, and I got Texas further down the list. So it may be that, you know, I haven't necessarily studied the draft prospects of these teams, but it may be that it was just a case of a lot of young teams.
Well, as I like your pick of West Virginia, but they also have only three starters back on defense, so you can't say that they were that young last year. The one I agree with most of your Big 12-ness. I like K-State. I don't like them quite as much as you do. I think they're a top 25 team. I wouldn't put them in the top 15. There was one thing that jumped out at me at your top 25.
Okay.
It's criticism. You ready for it?
Yes.
You are way down on Florida State compared to almost everybody else I know.
And when you say way down, seventh.
Seventh.
So, fair point about Florida State, but let's look at the teams I have ahead of them, and you can tell me who I'm nuts to have higher than Florida State. Number one, Alabama. Number two, Ohio State. Number three, USC. Number four, Penn State. Number five, Clemson. Number six, Washington. So, if you think I'm way down on Florida State, then I must be way high on somebody.
I would not have Florida State below three. So... I would have them some combination of Ohio State, Florida State, Alabama.
So here's where I should note that the last one of these I did, which was, you know, the morning after the national championship game, I did have Florida State in the top five. Here's what I'm worried about with Florida State. I didn't see or hear any evidence out of spring ball that their passing game is going to be much better than it was last year. They're going to be great on defense. Derwin James is back. No question about it. Even though they lost Dalvin Cook, who, by the way, it's absurd that he slipped into the second round. Congratulations to the Vikings on that steal. You know, with Cam Akers coming in. And I've always liked Jacques Patrick. He's fast. They should be good there. But what evidence do I have with them losing all those receivers from last year that, you know, they're going to, A, protect him better, DeAndre Francois, and, B, just have a more productive passing game?
I just have more faith in him in his second year in the system. They get their best player in the program back. That's Derwin James. They missed him. I think Cam Akers will be a big time guy right off the bat. Everybody I know who recruited him thought he was a special player. I don't know. I do have a lot of respect for Jimbo Fisher's coaching ability. So with a lot of, you know, they got 10 guys back. I don't know. I'm close to picking them as my preseason number one. I mean, I'm going to pick Ohio State as mine, but I have them right there with Alabama for number two. I have more confidence in them than I do in Clemson coming off of replacing Deshaun and winning the national title. I don't think Clemson's going to fall apart. I would pick Florida State out of there. I think they have better athletes on defense than Penn State does. And I have more confidence in them than I do in USC at this point.
On the one hand, I feel like Penn State was one of the best teams in the country by the end of last season. They bring back basically the whole offense except for one really good receiver, obviously. Why wouldn't they pick up where they left off and be a top five team? On the other hand, I mean, who's this? There's no real star on that Penn State defense. Is that really going to be a top shelf defense?
No, I'm not sure it will be. But having said that, I think they're like somewhere around 7 or 8 or 9, something like that, because I think their offense is as good as anybody, and I think their defense is pretty good. And to me, when you're in a very good division, which they are in, I think that makes them, you know, probably number 7 or 8.
Curious your thoughts on the SEC teams in here, because that was, you know, going into it, I actually had no idea who will end up being my second, third, fourth highest, etc. SEC teams, obviously Alabama, but then Auburn was the only other one I had in the top 10 at number 9. Jarrett Stidham, a big part of that, obviously. Georgia at number 12. Then you got to go down to Florida at 17. LSU at 19. That's about it.
You confident in the Auburn defense? They've lost some pretty good players.
Yeah, they did lose some pretty good players. I think they take a little bit of a step back, but they were pretty good last year. They kind of quietly, mm-hmm. after several years of being a weakness, really improved. Marlon Davidson's going to be really good. I just think their offense is going to be considerably better.
And you have Georgia in the top 12. Are you sold on Jacob Eason at this point in year two?
Yeah, I think he'll be pretty good. I don't know if he's going to deliver on the, you know, kind of savior hype that he had coming out of high school. I don't I don't know if he is that guy, but he wasn't bad last year. He just kind of had your typical freshman growing pains kind of season. Kind of reminded me of when Stafford started as a true freshman there. If you look up his numbers from that year, they weren't very good. I think he'll be better, and I think it helps to have both Nick Chubb and Sony Michel back there. He's going to have a lot. He's going to have a lot better supporting cast, and also just everybody knows what they're doing better. There's always that coach whose team takes a big step forward from year one to year two. And looking around the landscape, I feel like Georgia is that team.
Okay. I think you're going out on there. Also interesting to note you had Kentucky in your top 20, which kind of caught me off guard.
I don't have Kentucky in my top 20. I'm sorry about that. And Tennessee was a near miss.
Who is the team that you think you are most out on a limb compared to other people?
Apparently Florida State.
Yeah, I would say on that. Yes, I would agree.
No,
with you.
I'm very, as you said.
You're bullish on K-State. Wisconsin, I would not have had them that high, but I would not have had them do the things they did last year. So I
kind of feel like in these early top 25s, we know that some teams that were really good last year are going to tank and vice versa. That happens. I don't know that I'm ready to make those kind of predictions yet. I'm not straying that far from.
Would I be crazy to predict Nebraska to win that division this time?
No, I don't think so.
I think Tanner Lee will be a big upgrade from what they had at quarterback. So I don't know. I'm going to go that. I think I'm going in that direction.
So those are the two. I mean, Iowa could be in there. I don't know. Nobody can predict what Iowa will do from year to year, but it could be.
I feel like Josie Jewell is still there. I feel like he's been there since Brad Banks and they were like teammates.
Kansas State, I think, might be the team I'm higher on than most. I've seen this before. I mean, they went 9-4 last year. Nobody remembers that. They had a nice end to the season. They finished 9-4 and Jesse Ertz, the 18 starters back. Jesse Ertz, mm-hmm. This reminds me of some of his better teams where he needs to have a quarterback coming back. That's generally when they do their best. And then I don't know, they kind of made it to 9-4 last year. A little bit of smoke and mirrors. I think they'll actually be a really good team this year.
I don't disagree with you. I think they're a top 25 team. I'm just not quite. When I look at your math, I don't know if you can have a Big 12 with four top 15 teams in it.
Didn't that just happen?
Did it?
Yeah, 2 years ago we had the season where the Oklahoma State, Baylor, and TCU ended up not finishing that high, I don't think. But they went through that round robin where they were all in the top 15 because they all didn't play each other till the end of the year.
Yeah, I'm just saying they don't end up that way. They may get bunched at that point, but
well, these are not predictions. These are early May. Here's where things stand coming off
that's
spring ball.
That's your cop-out thing, huh?
I'll do predictions in August like everybody else, but this is not the time for that.
Okay. It dawned on me, Stu, this week are the big conference meetings out in Arizona, mm-hmm. Pac-12, Big 12. This year the Big 10 is out there, the
we'll
AAC.
We'll be there.
And we will be there.
By the way, have you seen the forecast for Phoenix this week?
No.
It's by the time we leave there, we will see triple digits.
Okay. All right. Well, that's not going to shock me. So what I was going to say is how crazy a difference it is a year ago. Do you remember a year ago at this time that, Art Briles was still the head coach at Baylor?
Yeah, believe me. I remember vividly him, kind of like just like business as usual, coming in and out of the meetings. And I remember one of the reporters, because the way it works is, I don't know, it's usually maybe in the neighborhood of 10 reporters. Mm-hmm. Although
last year there was more because the Big 12 had its.
Yeah. So there were more there than usual, especially from the Big 12. You're right. Just kind of milling around. And then if you know the coaches, they'll say hi and they're way in and out of the meetings. And I remember somebody saying like, do you feel kind of dirty now about Baylor and the coaching staff? And we're like, yeah, we do. And then Briles comes out of the meeting and there's kind of a scrum around him. And I just remember, this is so awkward. I'd already written my first really critical column. I'm thinking, mm-hmm. but we didn't have, I mean, I remember on this podcast debating and debating whether or not they would fire him. I thought, no way. You thought, you know, you had a feeling they would. I just remember right up until the day it happened thinking they're never going to fire him. So we didn't really have any hunch that that was a possibility at that time, and clearly he didn't either. And it was just kind of a business as usual chat, other than I believe you asked the one.
It was about Sean Oakman. I don't exactly remember what it was. And it was one of those where I was, you know, I was curious as to which way, okay, was that going to be the question that other people are going to kind of go in that direction? Because honestly, Art Briles was more engaged, like for people just curious about this sort of thing, the Pac-12 coaches are way more receptive to talking at these things than their Big 12 counterparts. I mean, short of Gary Patterson, you know, even the guys who are pretty friendly, the Dana Holgerssons, they kind of go on their way. And I think, Mike Gundy's probably the farthest end of the spectrum. He's like, you know, it's almost like the person who's like just walked out of a courthouse. You know, he does not want to be seen talking to you. But
there must be some sort of like before they break from the meeting, somebody must say like, OK, there's a bunch of reporters waiting outside. Don't talk to them, because, I mean, some of those guys just like could not try to get past us faster.
Yeah.
And we're not like there to do anything scandalous. It's just like this laid back, you know, vibe like, hey, you know, how's your team looking? Blah, blah, blah. But no, you're right. It couldn't be more different between them and the Pac-12. And I'll be interested to see this year with the Big Ten, first time they've brought their football coaches to this, how media friendly they are.
Well, you know, if Pat Fitz starts blowing people off and PJ Fleck starts elbowing people out of the way, then they're taking their cues from the Big 12.
Yeah. PJ will probably be a popular guy there.
He was, you know what? I remember seeing, I'm trying to, maybe the Mac is there. I remember running into him last year, 2 years ago. And he's the one guy, even in triple digits, who shows up in a, you know, in a suit and tie.
You know, the American will be there. What do you think about they did not waste any time after that draft number, mm-hmm, sending out the email Monday morning about their new strategic plan. And you got to admire the gumption, right? They've been saying for, I don't know, about a year now that they, you know, would like us to start referring to it as the Power Six. And you think, you know, okay, haha. But in this press release, it's as if that's already happened. This press release says, American Athletic Conference Commissioner Mike Oresko today released the conference's strategic plan, which focuses on providing students at its member institutions with the highest quality academic, athletic, and personal experience competing in a Power Six conference. They just use that term as if it's industry standard.
Hey, you know what? You get the shine after being the fifth team in the draft pool.
Well, do you think that's realistic? Do you think they will ever be viewed as one of the six?
No,
I don't either.
I don't think so.
No, because they do have good teams at the top of that conference. I mean, there's no question about it. But there's just the second half of the conference, maybe even if you start even higher than that, doesn't resemble a power conference in any way.
And yeah, and what you're talking about, or what we're talking about, and what a lot of people are conditioned to think of is meritocracy. And I don't think the people who are the decision makers who have the access and the power are all on board for a meritocracy at this point.
Well, you know, it's funny because in the BCS, which part of the BCS, I mean, there are many reasons for the demise of the BCS, but one of them was the pressure they felt from the Utah Attorney General and others about the access or limited access to the schools from those conferences. Well, they actually had a mathematical formula in place that if a conference in the Mountain West came close, performed at a certain level over, I think, a 3-year period, then they would become an automatic qualifier. No such thing exists in the playoff because, and this is a little kind of clunky to explain, but there's no unified contract. So in the BCS, there was, you know, these six conferences that were referred to as automatic qualifiers, right? In the playoff system, there is no such thing. It's just that the ACC has a contract with the Orange Bowl and the Big Ten and the Pac-12 have a contract with the Rose Bowl, etc. So the only way they could kind of crack that is if a bowl voluntarily, willingly said, we'd like to do that with you guys, like a Peach Bowl. We don't have a conference aligned with us right now, so we'd like to sign you guys up. And I just don't see that happening because they don't have big brand name programs,
right? They don't have the impetus to do it. So I don't know. It's just kind of a shrug your shoulders at it reality. It's unfortunate, but it's just kind of that's the way it is now.
Now, would you say, well, you did kind of say this already with the Big 12, but would you say the American is closer to the Power Five than the other group of five conferences?
It was last year. The Mountain West has some good football players in it. I think it is cyclical.
It is cyclical because what you just said, but this year they only had eight guys picked and they were all pretty far down the list.
Right.
Okay, so seeing as we're going to be in the same place, which happens so infrequently now, we should probably do a podcast from Phoenix.
Who would you most like to have as a guest on the podcast?
Harbaugh.
Well, let's continue
did
on
not
there.
Hesitate, right?
No.
Big Ten coaches are coming. I assume he'll be there, fresh off his vacation in Rome. So, of course, and I'm sure he'll be happy to do that.
Okay, who would be the second and third choices if we can't get Harbaugh?
Leach is always a good conversation. I'm sure that would be a very entertaining podcast.
Mm-hmm.
No?
I don't know.
Rambly?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not.
Okay, what about
PJ? He would not be my second or third.
Who's your second and third?
Who would be my second?
Is PJ Fleck one of them?
You know, we could add PJ Fleck on. I think we probably should. I'd say, you know.
Don't make any promises we can't keep.
I think we could get that one.
Okay.
You know, I would like to get. And he was a great guest. I had him on my, like, I think I did like four podcasts when I was at CBS, but one of them was Mike Gundy, and he was actually a very good podcast guest.
Oh, but I'm sure he would be a good podcast
guest. He is the, like, least likely guy to stop at this thing, though.
Well, we could just chase him all the way to the pool.
We have a better chance of cutting his hair while he's walking as opposed to, like, asking him to stop.
Oh, that's a good point. This is actually going to be my first time seeing the mullet up close. Assuming he comes anywhere close to us.
You won't see it up close.
I'll see it in person. I don't know how close I'll be, but yeah, that could be one of the highlights of the week.
You know how different the technology is? Remember a couple of years ago, you were all gung-ho on Periscope and doing it from there, and now you're not going to touch it.
No, I might. If people want, I did a couple Periscopes during the first round of the draft that did pretty well. We could do a Periscope, we could do Facebook Live. You know, we have a lot of idle time there while these guys are in meetings. We should probably do that too.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll have some surprise guests for you guys.
That's the key word there, surprise, because it's going to be a surprise to us too who it's going to end up being. As always, if you enjoy the Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, and take the time to leave a 5-star rating if you get a chance. It helps get the word out. We'll see you next time.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.